Good morning. It's great to be back with you again. It's been a while, and keenly aware that during the time since I've been here last, there's been a fair bit of grief in this congregation, so I wanted to acknowledge that as I start. In fact, launching into a topic like this, I actually asked permission to do this in the context of some of the things that you've been through and losing people who are dear to you. This is a sermon I've never preached before, but it's a sermon that I've wanted to preach for quite a while. And I'm approaching this with a little bit of trepidation, because those of you who've been around church circles long enough know that if there's ever a topic that someone says, I'm going to preach on something I've never heard preached before, almost certainly it's going to be heretical. Okay, so that's why I'm approaching this with a fair bit of trepidation. I've been a Christian for over 40 years now, and I've never heard anybody actually speak on the topic of whether God has a sense of humour. I think the most I've ever heard is somebody say something like, well, if you don't think God's got a sense of humour, look in the mirror. And that's been about the extent of what I've heard on this particular topic. So we're going to return to that look in the mirror thing a little bit later. But of course, if we do decide, end up deciding God does have a sense of humour, we need to decide, what sort of sense of humour does God have? There's clearly lots of different types of humour. And this irony, there's sarcasm, there's slapstick, paradox, just outright foolishness. We all know that there's a humour that converges on the cruel as well, something that humiliates the victim of the humour. So we're going to dive into this this morning. So if we look back at the book of Genesis, start right back at the beginning. Remember that bit where Adam and Eve wanted to hide after they sin? And they're hiding in the trees of the garden. And God says, where are you? Now, that's always struck me as incredibly funny. Okay? Because whatever understanding you have of God knowing everything, he probably had a pretty good idea of where they were. Okay? And in fact, it bears to mind, Deborah, I told her on the way here I was going to share this particular story. When she was a little girl, she liked playing hide and seek, like lots of kids do. But her conviction was that if she couldn't see anyone else, they couldn't see her. Which, of course, is not always the truth. And on my Facebook feed a few days ago, this particular cartoon popped up. Which catches something of the Adam and Eve thing, and perhaps something of you know, Deborah trying to hide, thinking, as long as I can't see anyone else, they can't see me. Okay. Now, with the Adam and Eve story, the humour flows on a little bit, in a sense, because the very next thing is, basically, Adam blames Eve, and Eve blames the serpent. The serpent, for some reason, is remarkably quiet at this point. But that idea of childishness, of, oh, it can't be my fault, it's got to be someone else's fault. Again, I find very funny. But it's very funny in the midst of what's happening in Genesis is also incredibly serious, isn't it? It's trying to tell us something that's very important about humanity. But there's humour there. At least I might just be the weird one, but, you know, I actually see quite a lot of humour in that particular passage. Children blame each other. Now, of course, we encourage children to grow out of this. We encourage them as they mature to move on from blaming other people and take some degree of accountability for their own actions. But, of course, we're all very well aware that there are some people who have an incredible number of growth rings on their personal tree who still haven't managed to achieve this particular goal of not taking responsibility for the consequences of their own actions and continue to want to blame anyone else. But that's another sermon entirely from where we're going today. No, I'm not going to. That's for another time. Okay, so I think in Genesis 3 we actually see gravity and humour coexisting, and I think that's worth thinking about. Now we're going to just jump over to a scripture in Samuel here for a minute, in 1 Samuel chapter 5. After the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then they carried the ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. They took Dagon, put him back in his place. But the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. And his head and hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. Don't know about you. I think it's funny. Okay, so you've got the Ark of the Lord taken into a pagan temple, and suddenly God's sense of humour says, firstly, I'm going to make this idol Dagon bow down to me, and then secondly, I'm basically going to smash it into pieces and put bits where no one else possibly could when they open the temple the next day. So there's an element of humour in that, and perhaps I think there's also an element of humiliation in that passage for the idol and the people who worship that particular idol. I think there's something in there that says a fair bit about God's sense of humour. Another Old Testament scripture, we probably know this one perhaps a little bit better, the passage with Elijah and the prophets of Baal, where there's that contest, you know, and we've got these, let's see who's real, let's see whose God is really real here. So I'm going to read a little bit out of this, and then one verse that I love the translation out of the contemporary English version. So this is out of 1 Kings 18, and it's kicking off at verse 25. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but don't light the fire." So they took the bull given them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. "O Baal, answer us," they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, and this is why I'm changing to the other version. At noon, Elijah began making fun of them. "Pray louder," he said. "Baal must be a god. Maybe he's daydreaming or using the toilet or travelling somewhere. Maybe he's asleep and you have to wake him up." Okay. So if we can assume, which I think is reasonably safe ground, that as a prophet of God, Elijah has something of the spirit of God, then, and this is going to be a profound existential moment for some of you, I'm about to tell you, then just perhaps those of you who have been burdened with the pressure of knowing that you have a deep inherent sense of sarcasm may be able to reframe it now as a prophetic spiritual gift. So feel liberated in that context, if that happens to be you. God is using humour here to humiliate somebody. In this case, false gods and those who worship them. This morning, when I was bringing Deborah a cup of tea in bed, she decided to see if she could outwrite my sermon. And so, by using AI. Okay. So she said, "Does God have it?" And some interesting things came out. And we'll come back to some of those. But while we're on the subject of laughing, God's sense of humour and that sense of humiliation of those who are in rebellion against God, there's some great verses in Psalms that say something like in Psalms 2 and Psalms 37, that God laughs at the plots of the wicked. Okay. Does God have a sense of humour? We're building up a little bit of a case here. We can see that spiritual gift of sarcasm, those of you who are currently rejoicing in discovering it in yourself, flows on into the New Testament as well. So Paul in 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians is pretty sarcastic, really, when he's trying to bring the Corinthians down to size. So if we go to, 1 Corinthians 4, and kicking off at verse 7 onwards, I think. Okay. "For who makes you different from anyone else? What do you have you didn't receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you didn't? Already you have, or you want. Already you've become rich. You've become kings, and that without us. How I wish that you really had become kings, so we might be kings with you." Anyway, goes on. Okay. Paul is being sarcastic in Corinthians. But there's something about us that tends to have issues with sarcasm, don't we? Now, I was brought up, as many of you would be, with hearing a statement ringing in your ears about now that says sarcasm is... Yeah, okay. I bet you've never heard the second half of that quote. It's a quote from Oscar Wilde, and it says, who doesn't get a lot of quotes probably in sermons, but it says, sarcasm is the lowest form of wit, but the highest form of intelligence. So for goodness sake, quote it in context, okay? So my mother, for some reason, only ever introduced me to the first half of that quote. I don't think she ever knew the second, so thereby limited my development of a personal spiritual gift, which, you know, which is very sad. But even if you only stop at the first part of that quote, it still says sarcasm is a form of wit, doesn't it? And don't we still laugh at sarcasm anyway, a lot of the time? Okay. So interestingly, though, the way Paul was using sarcasm is quite different from the way Elijah used it. Paul was using sarcasm with believers, not with people who are off busy worshipping, you know, false idols or something like that. He was using it a bit more forensically and, I think, redemptively. He was using it to gain a purpose, to win a purpose, okay, to get people's attention. So back to the Old Testament for a moment. We've heard the reading from the book of Jonah, and I was pleased to hear you guys laughing in the midst of that. I think if we can't read the book of Jonah without smiling, then really there's something a little bit wrong with us. So pausing for just a moment to review where we've been, we've seen that basically prophets and apostles can be quite sarcastic to make their point. We don't see God rebuking them for this. So I would say it's fairly safe to assume God's reasonably okay with it. And obviously when God's direct action with things like the prophets of Baal and the Dagon statue, etc., then I think we can say there's an element of humour, divine humour, that can humiliate, and an element of divine humour that has almost a slapstick overkill at work when we're looking, say, at Dagon and Elijah as well. I think it's funny if we allow ourselves to see it. Another aspect of humour that we're all familiar with is irony. And if we can sidetrack into my favourite area very briefly of church history, we can see this on the big screen. Now, if you'd been a gambler around about 70 AD or so, which happens to be the time that, you know, the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem, but you would have got fantastic odds if you'd said, I want to put a bet on the survival of this little group called Christians. Someone would have said, yeah, I'll give you big odds against that, you know. And if you'd said, they're not only going to survive, but they'll outlast the Roman Empire, you would have got fantastic odds on that. The only thing was you would have had to live several hundred years to collect on the bet, which is, you know, a bit of a downer. But history is replete with irony. My supervisor, the word he had to excise out of my thesis mostly was irony. You know, every time we meet, he says, Peter, not everything's ironic. My problem is I think most things are. So we differ a little bit on that. Yeah, so one of the benefits of being God is you get to live long enough to see the punchline of your jokes. You know? And those of us who study history get to be in on a lot of those punchlines. But back to that glance in the mirror. We're created in God's image. Well, I know there are great theological depths to this, which we're not going into because I'm majoring on being superficial today. But that should in itself be hilarious, I think, actually, every time we look in the mirror. I suspect God wants us to laugh about that from time to time. Another aspect of humour is paradox. And if we see something that we don't expect to be in a certain place, it can be really funny. And paradox is deeply embedded in the gospel. Again, in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 1:27, God chooses the weak things to confound the wise. 2 Corinthians 12, both paradox and irony are there when Paul is talking about his thorn in the flesh. And he says, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I'm strong. So these thoughts abound in Corinthians right through. The message of the cross is foolishness, for example, to those who are perishing, but the power of God to those being saved. In another verse, the foolishness of God is contrasted with man's wisdom. Many of us are probably familiar with a medieval character of the jester or the fool. All right, you're about to see at some point a character of a jester. And here we have another joke. This one's on me. A little aside, a few years ago I was preaching a funeral service for somebody out at Quarrenden. Whoa, there we go. And still day in October, you know, everyone's very solemn and you know, I'm about to take this funeral service and I stand up to the microphone, there's about 40 people there, and I inhale to take my first word and inhale a fly, you know. And so immediately said, well, this is the last joke Esther's been able to play on me, you know. Anyway, the jester or the fool, a character that we might be familiar with. Okay, some of you might know this from the classic Danny Kaye movie, I think, back from the 60s where he played this. The idea that you had a role in the king's court, that you could say whatever you wanted with immunity because it was taken that you were speaking in jest. I remember when I first went to uni, one of the first books I encountered was a book by a guy called Erasmus called In Praise of Folly, and writing in the early 16th century, criticising the Roman Catholic Church, he said the most outlandish things, but he said, I'm speaking as a fool, which meant you don't die, right? Because if you say what you're saying is a joke, you can say whatever you like. Very, very useful device if you wanted to live a long time in the Middle Ages. Now, this is a later concept than the biblical times, of course, but it captures the concept that what is truth to some is foolishness to others. And sometimes the only way to get through to people is to acknowledge it. So jesters were really the only ones allowed to speak the truth to power with immunity in the Middle Ages. There's a line in Shakespeare's King Lear where he says that, which of course is an incredibly serious play, but he says the fool, the jester, is often a prophet in Lear. And it seems to me that's something of what Paul is getting at with in Corinthians. Deb's AI sermon this morning, by the way, referred us to a passage of scripture I hadn't thought of engaging with. So nothing like sort of some last-minute alterations to your sermons on the basis of artificial intelligence served over a cup of Earl Grey, but here we go. So the book of Job turned up in a sense of God's sense of humour, according to artificial intelligence. And the idea was that AI, apparently, I'm not sure how well-developed AI's sense of humour is, but anyway, decided that what happens at the end of Job is incredibly funny, where Job comes to God with all these questions. They don't get answered, and God says, well, where were you when I did this? And by the way, can you have lightning bolts come out of your fingernails or something like that? And that led into another thing. I don't know if you guys have anything coming up on your social media feeds. Natural creation is incredibly funny. Some of the things God's made are really, really funny. I mean, I don't know if you've ever Googled blobfish, but you know, my boys and I have done this, and anyway, it's not the prettiest thing, but for some reason God's done this, and we can ask him about it one day. Anyway, you've got books, that's all right. I'll leave those with you. If someone wants to laugh later, you can go to Deborah. Nothing about blobfish in there, though, I don't think. Okay, so I've mentioned about prophets, apostles, direct action of God, but what about Jesus? Okay, isn't he a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief? We know there's a verse saying Jesus wept. There isn't an equivalent verse saying Jesus was rolling around on the floor laughing, I don't think. So where does the sense of humour fit in here? One of the problems, I think, with all of this is we've been trained to take Scripture so seriously, so incredibly seriously. And if we pause for a moment, and I guess this is one of the key ideas I want to get across, I think we should be able to take things seriously and still laugh about them. Now, it should be, in other words, a both and, not an either or. Now, marriage is a classic example. We know we're supposed to take it seriously, but what would a marriage be without any laughter? Raising kids? It's a serious thing, but isn't there supposed to be a lot of laughter with that? And perhaps even with our careers, you know, we want to be able to have humour and seriousness together. So, in fact, I think if we think about anything really worthwhile in our lives, any relationship or friendship, there's something there that says it's really serious and it should also be fun. There should also be laughter there. So let's start with the assumption that Jesus may have had a sense of humour and then go looking for it. So while he called Peter rock, for example, and when Peter was pretty tempestuous and, you know, not exactly a piece of granite, you wouldn't have thought. We also know Jesus was a master storyteller. Have you ever known a master storyteller never to use humour at all? One of the ways it's probably most obvious, I think, is with Jesus' hyperbole. Okay, so what about that, the image of the camel going through the eye of the needle? Now, we can perhaps conceive, sorry, I'm going to get a bit graphic here for a moment. We can perhaps conceive that a little bit easier in our days when we have food processors that can liquefy things. But it's a grotesque image of trying to get a camel through an eye of a needle. Or trying to get a splinter out of someone else's eye when you've got a log in your own eye. Or, you know, straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel. I don't know what it is about camels. They just keep coming up everywhere. Aren't these images so ridiculous that they're funny? This was part of the way Jesus spoke. There's irony in so many of Jesus' illustrations, in his parables, challenging the worldviews of both Pharisees and disciples. I mean, the thing about, what about when he calls the Pharisees whitewashed tombs with rotting? You know, the image from it, if I was going to do a paraphrase of that, it came to me today, I'd think of someone, it's like popping a corpse in a beautician's chair and ordering a makeover on it. You know, it's this bizarre, grotesque stuff here. But we just, oh yeah, we've heard this a million times. And so we don't actually get the humour. You know, it's like dad jokes that kids have put up with, you know, 50 times. They don't laugh anymore, right? We've become inoculated against this. What about consider the fruit of the Spirit? You know, when we consider that list, we know Jesus must have embodied all of those. Isn't joy in there, actually, somewhere? Doesn't joy tend to overflow in laughter? Now, we're not specifically told whether Jesus smiled or laughed at that first miracle in the wedding feast in Cana when he turned the water into wine. I don't know. I would imagine a few smiles were going on at the very least. If you think, that was water 5 minutes ago. Now you're telling me it's the best wine you've ever had. Yeah, I'd be laughing at that personally if I was Jesus. At least a wry smile, I think, I would allow myself. What about when Lazarus comes pogoing out of the tomb wrapped in smelly grave clothes? You know, this stuff is funny. Oh, yeah, it's terribly serious, and we know there's all sorts of messages in it, but can't we laugh at it, for goodness sake? Wouldn't people have laughed for joy at that instance? And yet I think the humour that is in the life of Christ and I think embedded in his life is much more profound than the odd joke. And it's embedded in every moment of his earthly ministry from the incarnation to the resurrection. I think Jesus was irony embodied. What could be more ironic than God being born through a human womb and dumped in a cattle feed trough? What could be more ironic than people having to figure out whether this is the promised Messiah or not, when he doesn't really fit the job description they've got in mind? And if you want to see that, the confusion around that, have a look at John chapter 7, where the whole spectrum is on offer there. What could be more ironic than people wanting to kill the one who offers life? What could be more ironic than Pilate claiming he has the authority over Jesus' life and death? Jesus responding that, no, you only have delegated authority. And then the very next verse, Pilate's shown he doesn't even have that because he is under the demands of the Jews. Doesn't have enough power to stand against the Jews clamouring for Jesus' death. How ironic is it that what Pilate does in putting the sign above Jesus' cross, the King of the Jews, and even the soldiers mocking Jesus are mocking him with the crown of thorns and the robe. The irony is just dripping out of everything to do with Jesus from birth to death. How the irony that the death of one brings life to so many. So irony and paradox are at the heart of humour and also at the heart of the Christian gospel. To be great is to be least, to give is to be rich, to serve is to lead, to die is to live. The rejected and mocked king is the glorified king. We acknowledge this paradox every Easter. We celebrate both Good Friday and Easter Sunday as two sides of the same coin. Now, I'm acknowledging here that irony and paradox don't only result in humour. They also take us to the profound areas of our faith. Yet, when talking about his death in John 16:20, Jesus says to the disciples that their grief about his death will be turned to joy. So at the end of Easter, surely there should be laughter. And yet God's embrace of irony, sarcasm, the occasional laugh out loud humour doesn't end in the pages of the Bible. Consider the church for a moment. In its veering between cruelty, outright buffoonery and undiluted foolishness, mixed with occasional spiritual highlights, we often despair of the church. And yet God perseveres. The history of the church is both terribly serious and terribly funny. I think in previous visits I've read out some jokes and you've had to earn chocolates from those, right? And you've laughed at them. Okay. None today, sorry. So the history of the church, terribly serious and terribly funny, but we often have difficulty seeing the latter, partly because the humour is often subtle. So obviously I know that you all know a fair bit in various ways about the history of the church, and therefore you know that the church often, unlike our master, deserves some of the mockery that comes at us and some of the scorn. The irony lays through that, though, is that though undeserving, we also will be glorified, as was our master. All of this shows how profoundly countercultural the gospel is. It's highly likely, to draw from both Shakespeare and the Bible, that if we want to be able to speak prophetic truth to power, we may need to become something of a fool in the eyes of the world. Fools who see the truth, speak the truth, don't worry about the cost, and have a bit of fun doing it. What if we lost when we lose sight of God's sense of humour? The risk, I think, is that we take God often so seriously that we can't acknowledge humour. We become humourless and unattractive as agents of God's kingdom. I think humour is not only and here I might have to defer to some counselling experts over on my right later. I think humour is not only an essential element in pastoral care toolkit, actually. I also think it's an incredibly important antidote to pride, especially when the joke's on us. Okay. However we look at God's sense of humour, I think it's redemptive. In the meantime, one of God's greatest and most serious jokes, the church, continues. Yes, we've got a serious purpose, of course. And sometimes we might feel a bit like a bumbling and staggering morass of clowns, but for some bizarre reason, which again I think speaks deeply to his sense of humour, God has not only chosen us but puts up with us. And if God often weeps over humanity, I'm sure also sometimes he laughs. I think we lose a lot if we don't think of God having a sense of humour. And I think that includes our own sense of humour. The day of Pentecost is what we're celebrating today. That was clearly a day of joy. I think the risk is, if we worship a humourless God, we become a humourless people. I think there's a call to balance both the seriousness and gravity of the gospel with a sense of laughter and joy. And I think in doing that, we'll better serve the God who has a sense of humour, laughs with us, and certainly often, I suspect, laughs at us. But this humour serves an overall bigger picture of redemption. Thank you. If you've got time for a few questions, just don't ask for too many jokes, okay?
I don't expect you to do this now, but a logical extension of your interest in this topic for me would be how understanding of Jesus' sense of humour would change our interpretation of some of the things he said.
Yep.
And I think I can think of examples right now, but I won't elucidate.
Just very simply, one of the things Linda and I do is watch Insiders on a Sunday morning. And what struck me, and the piece at the end of that, that's always about the cartoons of the week. And I was just thinking the power of cartoonists in our society to be prophetic,
mm-hmm.
and to pierce the powerful.
Yes.
Is a great gift.
Thank you.
Yeah, I probably was raised believing that God gave us a sense of humour that was not to be used unless when we thought he was around. But in that we are incarnational, or God is incarnational, surely the expression of being human is an expression of being God. And so the two are intertwined. Mm. And the other thing about humour, and I think that if I was in Jesus' time and I wanted to find him in the environment, I would have just listened for the laughter around him. Yeah. I'm just going to ask you.
while you're thinking about it, let me just add something that I thought of in preparation but didn't mention. And I probably only just have to say the four words. The laughter of children.
I just remembered, a joke isn't a joke until someone gets it. And so maybe that is how I perceive Christianity, in that until I got it, it was like everyone was understanding a joke and I was like not, I was gormless and not understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So actually receiving an understanding that God is embodied within people is a wonderful get, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about the way that people speak to, like you're talking about speaking to power, and there was one speaker we've had a couple of times who's talked about the very hard to catch allegories and whatnot that have been used by a metaphor, there's the word, used by people in very weak situations trying to speak to the church throughout the centuries, and humour being another angle of that, particularly in situations with a jester. I think in modern times we still have comedians who are trying really hard to use their place, their microphone, it's almost like a point in a comedian's career where they feel like they can really start launching into more than half of their time spent speaking to culture rather than making them laugh.
Yeah.
And they switch between them.
Yeah. I mean, while you're talking, it just reminded me of Martin Luther's 95 Theses. I mean, if any of you have glanced at those, they're deeply sarcastic, you know. I mean, surely, you know, if the Pope knew that St. Peter's is being built on the blood of his German servants, he would rather live in a shack, you know. Stuff like that, basically. There's sarcasm is right through.
Yeah. I was just thinking, John Cleese, I was just listening to him this week. He was talking about a very serious interview where he made people laugh and whatnot, but he was also talking about how easy it is to lose the line between, his words were, seriousness and solemnity. And you don't have to be both, and you can have humour laced with one.
Yeah.
And so just writing off a comedian just because they're making you laugh is, well, it's not safe.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say that it feels to me like where our need for power sort of sits, where we create dogmas and, you know, strict beliefs, it feels to me like there's a need to hold on. And it feels to me like humour is about holding things lightly to allow them to be challenged.
Mm.
The other thing is I I think I remember Claire talking about we read the Bible so literally these days. We don't get all of the context in which it was all written. We miss a whole layer of humour and wit and wisdom that is there that we just don't have. You know, like you say to anyone else around the world other than Australian, you know, flat out like a lizard drinking, and they're like, I don't know what that means. We all understand it, and there's so much of that in the Bible that we don't understand, which I think adds to the humour.
My family has a tradition of lots of humour, and we kind of revel in it, and it can cross the line. But at the same time, I think if we take ourselves too seriously, we do not grow. And it is that ability to see and acknowledge the foibles within us. These are usually growth points for us, and we can take that seriously, and we can also laugh. Yeah, so, and the other thing I was going to say, if we're in relationship, we bring the whole person. And so part humour is part of who we are. And if that's not, that we're not bringing the whole person to the table, and if we're not seeing the humour in the relationships in the Bible, we're not seeing the whole people.
Mm. Yeah, mine has nothing to do with the Bible. Yeah, I was just struck. I was just playing with that whole thing about sarcasm while I was listening to you. I grew up where sarcasm was used a lot, and it wasn't used with love and generosity a lot of the time. However, I kept thinking about, I don't know if anybody's watched Schitt's Creek here, but if you wanted to see sarcasm delivered with love and generosity, Schitt's Creek is full of it, and it's transformative. It takes very self-centered, thoughtless people and turns them into really loving human beings. And it's amazing to watch that happen over six series.
Okay. All right.